What does it take for a leader to think strategically? You'd hope I didn't need to ask this question, as it should be a core capability. But it's often not, as many focus on operational improvements, commercial negotiations, or tactics, all of which are important, of course. But it's critical to develop a clear view as to where the organisation should move towards, whom it should serve, and how it should win. And what winning really means. That way you can build the capabilities you need, identify the resources and systems, and evolve your workplace culture. In this interview, Rita McGrath, a professor at Columbia Business School and one of the world's leading management thinkers, tells me that strategy is more important than ever, given the complexity and uncertainty we face. But its practice needs to change away from the closed, top-down approach that characterizes many traditional organizations. She talks eloquently about the importance of leaders getting out to the edges of their organization to spot inflection points and pick up weak signals of change. She also discusses the qualities leaders need to nurture in themselves and those around them as they do this. Rita also highlights some fascinating practice at Microsoft and Klöckner, focusing on how they encourage new and different voices to share their perspectives on where to take the business. Rita is a wonderful guest, highly stimulating, very eloquent, and it was an absolute joy to speak with her. So Rita, thanks very much for making the time. You talk in your book, which I have right here. I have an early copy because I reviewed it for Strategy and Business. So that's an early copy, and it's well thumbed, I hasten to add. You talk about obviously mindset and perspective of leaders, you know, obviously seeing around corners. What does it actually take in your experience? You work with a lot of companies and leaders. What does it take for leaders to see their worlds differently? Either that shift from industry to arenas, from a sort of a bureaucratic process driven view of strategy to more experimental. What do they need to do to try and, you know, they may know it, they need to do it, but how do they actually make that shift in your experience?
Yeah, I think qualities like curiosity, empathy, the willingness to take in new information, the willingness to welcome new information are all part of this mindset, which has to do with, you know, we don't have the recipes anymore, and being willing to recognize that, I think is a really important starting point. I think they also need to be open to surprise. So, you know, a lot of people reject the idea of surprise, like being surprised means you were wrong or didn't have it right or whatever. Whereas I think people that are really good leaders in this time are sort of welcoming of new input, new surprises.
Yes. It's interesting, you it can take a leap of faith, particularly for people who've sort of grown up as a sort of managerial role, knowing sort of things in boxes to do that. Obviously, we've gone through a crisis. We're still in the midst of some form of crisis. Your views on, I see people seem to bifurcate from those who, if you like, double down on curiosity at these times. I know those who sort of narrow their worlds, whether it's down to insecurity, lack of capabilities and so on. What are your reflections on what a crisis like this has told us for the importance or the role of, I guess, strategy?
Oh, I think strategy is more important than ever, but it, in a different way than we've traditionally thought of it. I think that, you know, in many textbooks, even today, strategy is seen as this sort of, you know, metaphorical leader on a horse, you know, with the sword and follow me, you know, and here's the vision. And what I think we're starting to appreciate is how much the role of the leader is really... Linda Hill has a great way of describing this. She says, you know, taking individual slices of genius and forging them into collective genius. And so I think what the role of the leader is about is really how do I extract the very best from everyone in the organization? And I think one of the other things that has become very clear, I think, in this crisis is that, you know, the answers to whatever your puzzle is may come from very unexpected places. So it could be a junior person, it could be a person who normally doesn't have access to power, it could be you know, someone who normally it would be 15 years before anybody in the C-suite would pay attention to them. So I was having a conversation just last week, in fact, with one of the major European law firms. And on the call was a young woman who said, well, how does she get the right input from her boss? Because the boss isn't, clearly things are so uncertain, the boss isn't capable of sort of mapping out a very concrete roadmap for her. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, you know, what you need to understand is you have a critical role to play in that your where you are is different from where that person is and likely to be rich with all kinds of new information. So I think one of the things I'm starting to really appreciate is how organizations can really get that information from across the organization.
Yes.
Unexpected places are likely to really benefit.
Yeah, so people new to the organization, different backgrounds, maybe different in. Probably shouldn't use the word industry in this call, but people still think in industries rather than arenas. But what I see sometimes, and I'm not being a skeptic because I'm quite a positive person, but as I see people do sort of events, you know, they do sort of experiments, they do events, and they may be sort of typically in the summer months, at least in Europe, you know, you do an away day, you do an innovation day, you do a hackathon, and then you might do it again. But in between, it sort of quite easily reverts back to, well, that was interesting. Let's get back to this sort of the elite team at the top doing it, you know, setting it, and we'll ask you for your opinion when you deserve it, sort of approach. How do you, because you've been obviously a pioneer of sort of experiment-driven planning, experiment-driven sort of strategy, how do they sustain that sort of activity and process of encouraging people to share their voices and not revert back to a top-down hierarchical process?
Well, I think the first principle is you can't make it too difficult. You know, if you're going to take everybody and put them on a desert island for a week, I mean, that's a huge investment of time and energy, and people aren't going to sustain that. So I think what you need to build in is what Peter Sims has called little bets, you know, the opportunity for small scale exposure. So as a couple of examples, at Microsoft, one of the things they do in their regular leadership meetings is they actually beam in teams from all over the world that are selected by a group whose job this is to really expose the senior leaders to some interesting things going on in the company that they might not necessarily have done. So maybe it's 20 minutes out of a senior meeting, and it's one person's job to, you know, find that team, expose them. The team then, of course, is free to prepare and whatnot. But, you know, 20 minutes, you can do that on a regular basis.
Yeah, right. Sure. So don't bite off too much. You can tune. Don't involve it. And that was a big shift in culture for Microsoft, given that.
So one of my funniest stories about Microsoft, and then I'll give you another example, was I was invited to participate in one of their senior leadership meetings. So this is this big meeting that everybody, sort of top three levels, comes. It's 500 people, and they gather in this ballroom in Bellevue, Washington. And so I flew out there. Get off the plane, and I really, really, really wanted to be there for the day so that I could participate in what was going on. My session was until the next day, but I get there and sort of open the door at the back of the ballroom and look at the front, and there's this huge screen with the word empathy on it. And I was like, shoot, I am in the wrong place. This is micro, what, you know? But I think what Satya Nadella is really trying to do is say, you know, we have to look at leading indicators. We can't look at lagging indicators. And a leading indicator of whether we're going to be successful in the kinds of businesses they have now, which can't rely on monopoly power, right? They've got to rely on software as a service businesses, the cloud businesses. It's all about usage and engagement. Yes. And before people use our products and be engaged with them, they need to love us. Yeah. So I recently made a purchase through the Microsoft store. This was very interesting. And you get one of those, would you be so kind as to fill out this follow-up survey? You know, and if it was just me, Rita, in my normal life, I probably wouldn't have done it. But because I was, you know, because I study companies, I thought, oh, this could be interesting. Let's see what I can glean from this survey. And one of the questions was literally, how likely are you to tell others that you love Microsoft? I mean, I was like,
Wow.
Who am I talking to? Right? Am I talking to like veggie eating, you know, granola sort of fruit? And no, I mean, this is Microsoft. So the other example of a company that I think takes this getting out to the edges very seriously is a firm whose CEO every month has a system where this computer randomly generates a name to 20 employees. And from anywhere in the world, anywhere in the company, and he has breakfast with them once a month.
Wow.
And the deal is, you know, very nice catered breakfast. They fly them in from wherever they are in the world. And, you know, they go around the table and like, what do you see? What's going on? What's happening in your part of the room? You know, it's not, there's no sort of formal agenda. But if you think about it, 20 people once a month, it's a whole lot of people all over the company, randomly chosen. So there's no favoritism involved. You're going to get a lot of information you wouldn't have gotten any other way.
And they'll be multiplying to others in their networks and so on, which has a big halo effect as well.
Right. Yeah. Third example is the German metal services manufacturer, Klöckner, which I write about in my book. And what they did some years ago, now, you know, you have to sort of channel your inner German hierarchical company that's 140 years old. I mean, we have the chief director, and then we have the assistant chief director, and then the vice president for the assistant chief director. I mean, you get the idea. And their CEO was like, this is just too slow. We're never going to get anywhere if we have to continue with this very heavy infrastructure. And so one of the things they did was they implemented what he calls non-hierarchical communication systems, which in their case happened to be Yammer. And astonishingly, anybody in the company, literally anybody in the company, can send a message to the CEO. He can read it and respond. Now, obviously, he's not going to spend his whole day on Yammer, at least he's not. But just the idea of picking up, say, 10 messages a day.
Yes.
You know, from someone that he normally wouldn't have spoken to.
Yeah, it's a massive.
And again, he responds, the word gets out. He really is listening, and sometimes, you know, really important things come to his attention because it gets shielded by the bureaucracy, right? And then so when you have to actually have a direct communication with people, then it makes a big difference.
Yeah, that's a big shift. They're great examples. I mean, I went back to your, I've done my homework. You said that effective strategy is predictive, discovery, and data-driven and requires pattern recognition, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the last point, just building on your point around tech, is I've been exploring as somebody who's interested in artificial intelligence. I'm not a scientist in that space, but I've worked with quite a few. It sort of begs the question of what role could AI could play in the strategy, whatever process it is, strategy process. If you look at other parts of the business, I mean, you mentioned customer service there. It's fully into customer service, HR, sales, pharmaceutical optimization sort of problems, spots patterns. I just wondered in your own work, consultancy or research, whether you've looked at the opportunity for AI to shape strategy.
Oh, I think it. It's an input, right? I don't think it's going to make your mind up for you. And I think this is one of the things people get wrong. So one of the things I'm doing is I'm creating new software to help people with their innovation growth programs. And the kind of questions I get from people are, when is the software going to tell me what to do? I'm like, the software's not going to provide input.
You know, press the button.
It's
press
a tool. You know, it's a hammer. I mean, it's a very elegant, sophisticated hammer, but it's basically a hammer. So one of the things that I think AI does do is it makes that drudgery of sort of looking for insight much more rapid.
Yes.
So just as an example, one of the things that's part of the software that I'm building, I'm not building it. I'm overseeing it. The tech guys are actually building it. But one of the things we're looking at is something really simple. Like if I have an innovation idea that involves, I'll make this up, linking together something on a loading dock. And I have an idea coming up in Singapore, an idea coming up in India, an idea coming up in California. Wouldn't it be cool if I could sort of see that and then connect these people across the organization? So that's a very rudimentary example, but you never were able to do that before. I mean, it was just too hard, unless you had really, really evolved systems. And everybody hated those old knowledge management systems. I mean, that was always the holy grail, right? Which is, I'm sure at strategy and business, you had this, right? And you put stuff into the knowledge management system. Everybody hated it. So if you could take some of the drudgery out of it and make that part of your normal workflow, then I think it has huge potential.
Yeah. It's interesting you talked about the sort of, I guess, the software side. You've been, I'd say, a pioneer again in that space. I know you have either work or relationships with Strategizer, Strategy Tools, and obviously your own Tektronik. And you're probably, I was looking around, obviously, that's a sort of, I'm sure there's a term for it, strategy as a service, software as a service type approach, amongst other things. I know they do a number of things, but that's quite different for strategy, which, you know, in companies and in academia, which has been, as I say, historically, small teams, quite old school, maybe in terms of the sort of tech. I was just curious, was it the connectivity that appealed to you in terms of getting involved in that space, in terms of connecting people using the tech, or were there other motivations? Because you are one of the pioneers of the academic world, you know, playing in that space. There aren't many others, as far as I see.
I'll take innovation just as a point of departure, because I think one of the things that has happened in strategy since I started in the field was, you know, when I first started, all the cool kids were doing industry analysis, you know, order of entry, and what was your R&D intensity, and blah, 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 blah. And those of us studying innovation, you know, we were interested in the insides of firms, and we were actually interested in people. And the mainstream in the field was not interested in people. They were interested in things like, you know, industry presence and organizations with bugs. So in the intervening period, what's happened is innovation and strategy really come together in a big way. So if you take innovation software, just as an example, you've got a mountain of software, which is great at the idea capture part. So you've got companies like ViaScale and Sprocket, and, you know, all these companies that do kind of capturing ideas, ranking them, rating them, deciding which ones we go forward to, running campaigns. I mean, you know, all that stuff. And then if you take it right to the other end, you've got a ton of software that'll do project management for you. So, you know, what needs to come first? What needs to come second? What are the dependencies? So when the thing's pretty well known, you can scope it out. And what there is in the middle is this like dust bowl of nothing. It's still Excel and PowerPoint.
Yes.
And all that. So the company I'm actually commercializing this through is called Valize, V-A-L-I-Z-E, which is the one I'm doing. And I never wanted to be like a software person. That was not my intention. But what I found was people would come to my classes and, you know, we'd have a session and everybody would be inspired. The light bulbs would go off. And then they get back to the company and it's like, well, what is this? Is it a spreadsheet? Is it a...
There's a big gap.
How do I make this work? So part of the goal of the software side of things is to help people quickly operationalize what we know works from, you know, years of working in this field. And I think there's just a real lack of tools. And what has been interesting in exploring the software space is a lot of people are coming into the software space with software backgrounds, and they have no idea what is necessary from a management point of view.
Right. They need some content.
And so they build all this software kind of on a theoretical, you know, understanding of what is necessary from a management point of view. Whereas I kind of did the management view first and stumbled into the software.
Yes.
Which has its pluses and minuses. But I think what...
You need both.
I think what I bring to that area is a real understanding of where does innovation get gummed up in companies. And by extension, where does strategy get gummed up in companies? Because, you know, it's not that it's not absolutely clear to everybody that the right thing to do is X. It's that might be the right thing to do, but that's not what my budget says, because I inherited my budget from 2 years ago and my budget's telling me to do this and the strategy says to do that. And so how do you resolve that conflict? How do you even make it visible? My incentives, you know, so we have the big strategy offsite and we argue for 3 days about the difference between vision and mission, and we get the t-shirt, you know, that says we're going to be the best investment investors ever made, the best company our employees will ever work for, and the most responsive, our, you know, the t-shirt. Anyway, and then we get to the resource allocation process and everybody's like, oh my God, I'm exhausted. That process just took every ounce of spare time. I need to get back to work. And so, you know, you have a strategy that's new and shiny and lovely, and then all the other things, the incentive system, the budgeting system, the way you allocate rewards, the power system, the structure, that hasn't changed at all. And so it's a long-winded way of saying it, but I think one of the goals of the software was to try to just make that whole thing easier. So that's really where the incentive for it came from. And, you know, we'll see.
I'm fascinated now. Well, I was before, but I'm even more fascinated. What stage are you at in terms of that particular?
We've got two levels. So one level is what I'll call the sort of cheap and cheerful level. So it's a quick diagnostic or a quick survey, or, you know, here's a thing that you can do. And that's meant to be very accessible, very fast, sort of an entry level, call it that. You know, and that could be little companies, it could be individuals. And so that's actually launching this week.
Well, congratulations.
We're starting with a team effectiveness diagnostic.
Right.
which is just kind of 20 questions. How's your team doing? And I decided to start there because in as you are living, we're all, you know, distributed now. We've got 1,000 things that we've got to deal with, like in our normal lives. And how on earth are you going to focus on being an effective team member in this environment? So we thought that would be a nice one to start with. And then at the more sort of heavy duty enterprise level, we're in, I would say, advanced beta. Like I could show you a demo and it actually works, but there's a few bits of polish it needs. And like it's a bit like you're building a house, right? You've got the frame and the foundation and it's all there, but there's still cardboard boxes in the dining room and you don't really want, you know.
Need a lick of paint or something around it. Yeah.
So that's kind of where that is. The good part is the structure is there. You know, the bones are there. So
got some strength and resilience, which you need this time. So that's good. I just want to change course definitely look out for that. That sounds fantastic. One thing I want to change course, if you look over, say, the last year or so, obviously most of which has been virtually, and you looked at the conference, the meetings, the seminars, the companies you worked in, you thought, well, apart from your own brilliant work, you thought, oh, there was an idea or two that is just sort of, you know, coming up through the weeds, if you like, or that's the wrong term. It's beginning to blossom. It's coming through the weeds. What would be the areas you think, you know what, we haven't solved that, but that has promise?
Sure. So definitely looking at different ways of thinking about the future. So there I would cite the work of Amy Webb. I think she's amazing and wonderful.
Yeah, she is very talented.
I think one of the more interesting things is this notion of psychological safety that Amy Edmondson's been working on for years, but it's now really coming into its own. And the reason I think that's so valuable is it really ties together with what we were talking about earlier, which is if you're a leader who wants to get input from multiple sources, you absolutely have to have people willing to speak up to you, you know, because if they're feeling afraid or they're worried about getting punished or they're feeling like, oh, you know, my view isn't going to get appreciated, you're just not going to get this vital information. Yes. And Amy's a great example of, you know, she came up with this idea in the 90s. Yeah. And then 15 years later, Google went and rediscovered it. You know, and they got all the credit for it, right? And so I went all sort of Avenger focus and I was like, no, give credit where credit is due. This was the original idea. And I think now she wrote a book called The Fearless Organization. And
yes, I read it, yeah.
Getting the acclaim that she deserves. So futurism, psychological safety, I think in terms of new strategy thinking, I think we're starting to really understand that you can't sort of look at strategy formulation and strategy implementation as separately as we often did in the textbook class.
Yeah.
Oh, the other really new thing I think that we're just starting to nibble at the edges of is this whole notion of platforms and ecosystems, where the most powerful way to compete is often by leveraging some kind of ecosystem dimension, so that we're complementary goods or an ecosystem relationship. And the flip side of that is, I think even today, we still have this notion of firms as determiners of their own destiny. You know, so the entrepreneur goes out into an empty field and lightning strikes and, you know, holds images and all that. And I think somewhere in the back of our brains, we still have this idea. And yet when you think about the businesses that have succeeded, in many cases, they were in the right place at the right time in the sense that the ecosystem was ripe. So if you may have seen this wonderful documentary, I think it was made last year, about the firm General Magic. Did you see it?
Yeah.
I forget what the title of it was, but you know, they had the iPhone the 1980s. I mean, they had everything. They had a device, it worked, it interacted, it did all this magical stuff. And yet the ecosystem was hopelessly immature. You know, we didn't have bandwidth, we didn't have connectivity, we didn't have the internet, we didn't. And so even though the individual product was absolutely brilliant, we didn't have the surrounding support for it. So if I think about autonomous vehicles, just to bring it up to the current date, you know, there's all this commotion about autonomous vehicles. And it's like any other inflection point, huge amounts of investment, huge amounts of hype. Oh my God, we're going to strap sensors on a Volvo and send it out into the suburbs. And you know, as with most of these things, the problem is not the technology. I mean, the technology is actually really good for technology. But there's still two problems. The first problem is an immature ecosystem, by which I mean we don't have a business model. We don't know who's going to own these things. We don't know who's going to take the risk. We don't know who's going to insure them. We don't know will they even need to be insured. Is it going to be run by a city? How are all the standards going to be harmonized? So the technology is like the least of your problems. I mean, the problem is if I have an accident, you know, is it the insurance company? Is it who bears the risk? So that's the first problem. And the second problem is that we don't have, as I said, a business model. So after all this investment, who is actually going to make money on this? And it's still kind of a huge question. So we all see the promise. It's very clear that this could make, for people like the elderly or people who are homebound or people who can't afford a car, this could be a super amazing thing. But there's so much that's not ready yet. And until those things fall into place, it's going to be a very hard effort to commercialize that technology successfully.
It's interesting you talk about ecosystems. I worked with a number of organizations that have been orchestrators and partners in ecosystems. And the best have their strategy and innovation sort of process has involved their other members of the ecosystem in different shapes and form. They should, that's the main. Others have, if you looked at their value, whatever value map of their organization, their participation in the ecosystem has been absolutely critical to it. And then you say to them, so when you've been developing your next 1 year, 3 year, month and plan, year plan, and what sort of conversations have you had with some of these others? And they say, well, no, that's confidential. And so they're sort of operating in an ecosystem, but their process is still a vertically integrated mindset. And so it's an issue. Another thought, I guess a lot of your approach from what I've seen, read and listened to is a sort of dynamic, fresh, energizing sort of human side of strategy and innovation. That's how it comes across to me, with a commercial edge, of course. I guess there's a tension there, right? Because I guess at some stage you have to sort of take a longer term view. Yes, place bets as you go through, take a longer term view, have time for reflection, not keep sort of shifting and moving. How are the best sort of companies you've seen get the right balance between, if you like, the dynamism, you've got real-time information coming in, you've got lots of collaboration, as well as saying, okay, actually, this is the path.
Yeah. So I would say some of the companies I admire most really do put innovation at the core of strategy, and they don't let it be an afterthought. It's not like it's separate from their strategic consideration. So if I were to take maybe three examples. First example would be the SAS Institute. So venerable company, routinely regarded one of the best places to work, incredibly innovative. They were big data before we knew what big data was, right? Founded by a professor, which, sometimes we do real things. but what they do every Tuesday is their entire senior team sits with groups that are doing innovation work. And they hear them out in terms of what's new, what's fresh, what are you working on, how's this going? And it's that regular paying of attention. It's on the agenda. It's not in the background. And at the same time, that meeting's, let's say it's 2 to 5 or something. But the 1 o'clock meeting's all about, oh my God, here's what happened with Microsoft this week, Right. And so you've got that very deliberate allocation of time. Second example would be Corning. In Corning, publicly traded company, but their strategy has been for years. We want to be 10 years ahead of our customers. So if you're going to be 10 years ahead of your customers, then, their CEO will talk about judgment. He said, as an innovative company, innovation right to the core, you need to exercise a lot of judgment because you don't have a lot of data. And so they're quite firm about that. And then the third example would be the company that invented Siri, among other things. And what their CEO would do is every Monday, put all the innovation teams together, and they would each kind of give an update on where they were on their different processes. And so I think there's this kind of human side of how you manage the agenda of the organization to balance the need to be very responsive and dynamic with this sort of, let's take the time to really look at what's going on in a more, a longer term view. And that flows over into something I work on a lot, which is how you allocate resources across your portfolio of activities.
Yes.
And what I find most companies don't really have is a really good line of sight into what they're actually spending their money on. And the larger and more complex the company, the less line of sight you have. You know, so if you're the CEO of a Colgate Palmolive or something, and I don't mean this to be specific to them, but a company of that size,
that sounds
by the time you get to where project level decisions are actually being made and someone says, I've got it, we're going to put sensors in a toothbrush. By the time you even find out about it, 9 months have gone by. So I think there's a very interesting need to kind of get more transparency in line of sight across those different things.
Yeah. Rita, we could speak for hours and I'd love to, but I'm respectful of time. I try to be courteous. And so we said half an hour. Uh-huh. I think it's probably draw it to a close there.